The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
This is the Peter Boyle Show.
Morning, everybody, on a Wednesday. It's in the 7, May the 5th, Cinco de Mayo, 710 KNUS, Denver's talk station. Thanks for being here. And it's beautiful out there this morning. It was rain coming into work this morning, but the cast says maybe some afternoon rain. We'll see it. Tomorrow, sunny, warmer, 73, Friday, 82, and Saturday, 70, and storms come. In the next hour, John Eastman comes on the radio show. He has two attorneys, Chuck Bonnewell and, of course, Randy Corcoran, about what happened to him up at CU, but there's far more to the interview than that. In the meantime and in between time, I saw him two Thursday nights ago on a get-together over a pending book entitled The Holly. And Greg Moore was in Denver. He ran the Denver Post for, I think, God, 15, 16 years. He's been a longtime friend. I've been after him to do radio shows for a long time, and he's done it. Hey, Greg, thanks for doing it, man. Good morning, and welcome to 710.
Yeah, good morning, Peter.
Yeah, you know, were you at the Boston Globe when the expose dropped down on Whitey Bulger being a snitch for the FBI?
Yes, I was there.
Would you tell that story?
Yeah, so there were a couple of reporters who were part of the investigative team, which we used to call and still call the Spotlight Team, Jerry O'Neill, Dick Lair, and a police reporter extraordinaire named Kevin Cullen. And they had been, you know, sort of investigating improprieties in the FBI, which actually led to a much later scandal. But during the course of their reporting, they had heard rumors for years that the FBI had been protecting Whitey Bulger, and they were trying to get to the bottom of why he was able to escape the noose so many times. And what they discovered over the course of their reporting is that he had been a longtime FBI informant, that he had been a central informant against the Irish Mafia, which was called the Winter Hill Gang, and that by giving up, you know, leading characters and leading players in the Irish mob, he was able to enjoy free reign, you know, as a criminal, you know, basically running South Boston. So that's basically what they did. They uncovered that. It was denied for years and years and years. And then later, subsequently, it came out that, in fact, he was an informant. And that came out during the course of a major investigation that took down a top FBI investigator who grew up with Whitey Bulger in South Boston named John Connolly. Fantastic story. And I think there's a book that's called, I wish I had known you were going to ask me this, I think it's called Black Hand or something like that. I'll get the name of it, but there's a book that's based on the Boston Globe reporting that, you know, nailed Whitey Bulger as an informant. Until the day he died, he denied he was an informant. The worst thing you could be in South Boston is a rat.
Are you, by the way, are you on a speakerphone? Somebody's saying you're on a speaker. Are you on a, speaker?
I am. Can you hear me?
Much better. Thank you. It's cleaner. Greg Morris here.
You want me to be on a speakerphone? Please,
no, I want you to put it on your ear so that because we bounce through stuff here on between you and on air. When you mentioned that, we were talking about something else, and you said about when they took down Whitey, that was, and didn't the Globe also do? Were you there when they did the Catholic Church? Were you part of that?
Yeah, I was there for the beginning of that. So we actually launched that whole investigation right before 9/11 happened in like July of 2001, we didn't actually win the case in the courts to get access to those files from a Catholic church until like December of 2001. And we were like full-fledged out on 911 coverage. As you know, two of the planes that hit the World Trade Center were from Boston. So that was a very local story for us. And then in January of 2002, we published the very first story based on the records we got access to around the Catholic Church scandal. And then I left in May of 2002 to come to the Denver Post. But I was there for the beginning of that and, you know, see some of the initial coverage actually appear in the paper. It was a really gratifying moment.
Greg Moore's here. Back and forth to those two stories.
Yeah.
The Whitey story was, and then in the end, Whitey was murdered. And this is where I'm bouncing in and out of. I'm so drawn into Jeffrey Epstein, and I'm now on my third book, which shows you I got to get a life of Jeffrey Epstein. And Jeffrey, right. Greg Moore's here, and Jeffrey Epstein has a brother named Mark, and Mark hires a guy named Michael Badden, who's a forensics guy. And he comes out, he said, yeah. They murdered Jeffrey Epstein in the cell, had to go. And how long, there's all these stories I read about Whitey that they were moving Whitey, but they gave Whitey up. They wanted to kill Whitey. Whitey was, and again, dead men tell no tales, which would say about Jeffrey Epstein. But Whitey had to go, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for a long time, what we thought at the Globe was that, basically, they weren't really looking very hard for Whitey Bulger.
That's right.
He was on the lam for like 15 years. Like, basically, what had happened was the FBI had gotten a tip that Whitey Bulger was coming through Logan International Airport and had like $10,000 in cash with him. And he was also traveling with his girlfriend. And right when the cops were going to nab him, somehow he knew it was going to happen, jumped over some turnstiles and escaped. We're like, what? He escaped, okay, and then he went on the lam for years underground. We heard reports that he was in Louisiana, London, Greece, you know, Cuba, whatever, and we didn't think that they were looking very hard for him because if he had been captured, he would probably sing like a bird and tell all the FBI secrets. But, you know, finally he got caught in Santa Monica, California, you know, was brought to jail. And ultimately convicted, and as you said, he was murdered in a federal prison when he was being transferred from wherever he was in Boston, I think, to a federal prison in Atlanta. Within an hour, he was dead.
Greg Moore's here. Did you ever read the story on how they got the heads up on Whitey? Remember,
I've read
When you and I were kids, my idol's Joe Namath. And Joe Namath did remember when he did that, the woman shaved Joe Namath and he shaved that famous mustache. I remember that really hot blonde woman. She's Miss Iceland. Like a geek. I like you. Neither one of us have a life, so we read a lot. And so she now lives in Reykjavik, and she's watching CNN. She's watching CNN after 9/11. I don't want to say blows over, but after it ends, and then the feds are buying time, showing Whitey, and they're looking for Whitey. And she's in Reykjavik. She said, "That's my neighbor." No, this is for real. I mean, this is for real.
Wow.
This is for real.
Yeah.
And she said, so she calls the FBI and they hang up on her.
That's the FBI.
Yeah. Well, you and I feel the same way about the FBI. But she calls. She said, that guy you're showing there, we're looking for Whitey. She said, he's my old neighbor, lives next door. He and his wife, and they got the dogs and all this kind of stuff.
Right.
Because it was a big, I forget the number. It was a lot of dough. They put a big reward up for Whitey.
Oh, huge, yeah.
And so she called back, and she said, I need to speak to your supervisor. And she gave herself up. I'm, you know, whatever her real name is, and I'm the woman that shaved Joe Namath. And, hey, that's my neighbor, because she tried to be an actress, and she lived in California. That's how they got Whitey. That's how they got Whitey.
Wow. I've seen and read almost everything that the Boston Globe has written about that. I probably ran across that little anecdote, I didn't remember that. But, yeah. And the way they did it was really amazing. Like, they got her to knock on they basically called up Whitey Bulger and basically said, hey, it looks like somebody broke into your locker down in the garage. You need to come downstairs.
And
he goes downstairs, and next thing you know, bam, there are 100 guns on him, and he goes, you got me.
Yeah, okay? He gave it up. They thought he'd go out hard, and he didn't. He just.
Yeah. But not at all. He's like, hey, you got me. Down on your knees. That's it. That was it.
So, did you ever see him in life, in real life?
Oh yeah. So like he used to own something called the South Boston Liquor Mart. It was basically a liquor store, right? Now, maybe about 5 minutes from the Boston Globe, because we were right on the edge of South Boston and Dorchester. And so I was just running over there to get, you know, some scotch or something like that. And there was this old dude sitting outside in a lawn chair, like, you know, what you and I, our grandparents sat in, you know, you know, vertical, horizontal, you know, little stripes and stuff. So he's sitting there right outside the store. I go in the store, I get my scotch, I come back out, I say hi, whatever. And somebody says, hey, you know, that was Whitey Bulger that you passed. And I was like, wow, just the unassuming guy just sitting there, you know, whittling away with a stick and a little pocket knife. That was him. But he kept watch over, you know, South Boston and North End, which was very Italian. You know, he kept watch over some of those places. And, yeah, so...
Did you ever meet his brother?
Many times, yeah. The senator,
yeah
Billy Bulger. Many
Billy
times.
Bulger, His best friend was Ted Kennedy.
Yeah, a very erudite. He studied the Greek classics. He could speak Latin. Very cultured, but also very, very protective of his brother. And like he told the FBI, like, yeah, I mean, I would never give up my brother. I mean, they put taps on his phones or whatever. He's like, and no matter what, I'll never do it. And, you know, the Boston Globe spotlight team had done numerous investigations of corruption at the State House. You know, some of it involving William Bulger, who was the Senate president. And he always escaped the noose. And we never really knew why or how that happened. And, you know, right now I think the general speculation, the accepted wisdom is that he was able to escape, you know, prosecution in part because his brother traded other information for his freedom.
That's my belief, too.
But he was a great guy. I went to his office once. I mean, you know, you could not meet a more charming guy. You just couldn't.
Yeah, he had
perfect, impeccable manners. I mean, just impeccable manners. And even though he hated the guts of the Boston Globe, he always was a gentleman. Always. So
our guest, the one and only Greg Moore. I've been wanting him to do this show. I get drawn into these people. Whitey Bulger was there's a program the CIA ran, which brings me back to my other great group of people. Was called MK Ultra, and they dosed people with LSD, and
that must have been fun.
They did it to Whitey. Whitey went to Atlanta, and you know, one of his many trips to prison, and he volunteered for MK Ultra. They either did it to you as a surprise to see how you'd act, or you could volunteer to get dosed. Whitey did allegedly 40 acid trips. And remember that guy, they called him the Rifleman? What was his name? Fleming, I think, was his last name.
Oh, yeah. Fleming, of course.
Yeah,
Stephen Fleming was his name.
Stephen, thank you.
Yeah.
And they said, those guys said, when Whitey came home, as crazy as Whitey was when he went away, he came back worse. And he'd been in part of the MK Ultra experiments in Atlanta, in the prison in Atlanta. And it got him out early. Got him out early.
And, wow. Did not know that. Yeah, so, well, I mean, he was ruthless. Like, when you... So the name of the book that the Boston Globe did is called Black Mass,
yes.
M-A-S-S.
That's the name
of the book.
I read it.
And, you know, you find out just all the horrible things that he did and how he used to pull the, you know, he killed somebody or have someone killed and they would pull out their teeth and, you know, cut off their fingers and stuff like that and bury them under houses and foundations. And then, you know, I mean, like he was just a ruthless, mean, cold-hearted guy. And maybe the LSD had something to do with it. Wow, I didn't remember that.
Do you ever see a film, and I'm sure you have, called The Departed? You know, it's Nicholson.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite movies.
Yours and mine.
Next to Donnie Brasco. Donnie Brasco is absolutely my favorite. But,
I've
seen The Departed.
I did an interview with Joe Pistone, the real Donnie.
Wow.
And, I mean, not face-to-face. Not face-to-face. He was a phone interview.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, he said, the real badass, he said, and they talked about at great length, you know, the guy that took it for him was Sonny Black.
Yeah, my God.
Sonny Black brought him in, and it wasn't the Al Pacino character. It was Sonny Black.
I did not know that. Yeah. Is that right? It was Sonny Black.
Sonny Black
actually brought him in.
Yeah, and Sonny paid for it. Sonny paid for it. They killed Sonny. Because I was a geek. I read the book, and I saw the film. He said, "No, he's everybody misunderstands." He said, "The Pacino character," he said, "was a real bad guy, Lefty Guns." And
right.
He said, "No," he said, "it wasn't him. It was Sonny." And he said,
wow.
"And so when the murders took place because they had brought Donnie in or Joe Pistone in, that they killed Donnie. They killed Sonny Black.
Sonny Black. Wow.
Sonny Black was killed."
But, I mean, that's a hell of a movie, and of course they take some literary license, but yeah, I mean, you know, it's hard to cry at a mafia film, but when the Al Pacino character gets the call that he's going to, take one for the team and kisses his wife goodnight, takes off his watch, takes off his ring, puts it in the drawer so she can find it, after he's gone, I was like, wow, man, even in a cold-blooded gangster movie, they can find a way to make you cry. So, it's quite a film.
People don't know. Greg Moore's here, retired, of course, from the Denver Post, longtime friend. We'll talk about a book that we both now love. But what was interesting to me is there really isn't, and you lived it and covered it, and I just kind of grew up in the neighborhood, but organized crime in Denver, well, if somebody said there's organized crime in Denver for a kid from, I know you grew up in Cleveland.
Right.
What do you say when somebody says organized crime in Denver?
I say the Vendomes or what? Mm-hmm. I kind of forgot their name.
Small Dons.
I think, minor league, compared to East Coast Mafia, minor league. That's what I think. I could live to regret that.
I think you're right. Have we ever waved off? I mean, you were in the. I know you're with the Plain Dealer. We've talked about this, and then onto the Globe. Did anybody ever wave you off of anything for those reasons?
Well, I used to cover the garbage wars in Cleveland, right? Small time mafia, they control, landfills and the trash pickups and all that. And so when communities would have put out the bid, the waste contract, mafia guys, D and them, and those kind of guys would show up at city council meetings to make presentations, right? And so, we start writing about what their backgrounds were, like how long they've been in the trash business. It'd be like 18 months, stuff like that. So, I remember one time we were doing a story, and this guy, I forgot his name now, he just came up to me and he said, "Look, you really don't want to dig around too much on this." And I was like, hey.
Oh, you're right.
It's a $15, $20 million contract. There are the fish to fly. I mean, that sort of became a little bit of a back burner for me. But, I mean, it was serious stuff. Like, people were getting hurt, arms getting broken, houses firebombed, because people were saying, "Well, I'm not sure I'm going to vote for that contract."
Boom.
But the story that I really remember in Cleveland, and it's so funny because I was just talking to Walt Bogdanich, the great investigative reporter, probably has won 4 or 5 Pulitzer Prizes for the New York Times, but we worked together in Cleveland, and this is very similar to the Whitey Bulger story, but he was able to break a story with another reporter that fingered Jackie Presser, who was the head of the International Teamsters.
Yeah, he was in the union. He was a snitch.
He was from Cleveland. Yeah. I knew Jackie Presser. I used to see him at meetings and stuff.
Wow.
And he broke the story saying that Jackie Presser was an FBI informant.
Yes, he was. He was a snitch.
Yeah. And so that story is on the front page of the Plain Dealer. And see, I had just become an editor, so it would have been in like 1982 maybe that they broke the story. Yeah. And I'll never forget that a higher up in the Justice Department named David Margolis wrote a letter to the Plain Dealer basically saying that was a lie, that the story was inaccurate, and demanding that we retract the story. And there were all kind of meetings and pressures and stuff like that. And ultimately, the Plain Dealer retracted that story. Walt Bogdanich left soon after to go to the New York Times. But years later, after Jackie Presser, died, it was confirmed that indeed he was an FBI informant.
Sure.
And one of the things I learned from that story is that powerful people will tell all kinds of lies to protect things. and that only the most dogged journalism can really get to the root of what's truly happened. And that's one of the reasons why we need, you know, good journalism, and we need good books to help, you know, tell stories that, you know, in real time get suppressed.
And Jackie Presser after Fitz, and it was Jimmy, then Fitz, and then...
Yeah.
That's probably why, well, it's why Jimmy was killed, but...
Let me just tell you, okay, like, they didn't play around. Oh. Like, you know, Jackie Presser, you know, he didn't even think he was threatening you when he was threatening you. He was just telling you a fact, okay?
Yeah.
He was just telling you a fact. You're going to get hurt. If you do that, you're going to get hurt. And he wasn't playing around. Murray Hill in Cleveland, Ohio, anybody from Ohio that's listening to Cleveland, they know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of bones buried, okay, under restaurants and, you know, things like that in Murray Hill, which is the Italian section of Cleveland. You didn't play around there. You didn't even go to an Italian restaurant there if you weren't from that neighborhood. You knew something bad could happen to you when I was a kid. So,
oh, yeah. Remember that great line that was in, and he said, when you're coming here, you call in advance.
Exactly.
You call me and tell me you're coming.
Exactly.
I want to know.
And I'll make sure that, you know, you can get in and get out.
Yes.
Right.
And I saw, you know, as a kid growing up, just working class little steel mill town, but, you know, I don't know. I mean, I come back to the dailies. We were talking about this the other day, Royko's book, Boss, and all that kind of stuff. And grudgingly, Royko says in the end, there's no garbage strikes, there's no teacher strikes, there's no firefighter strikes. You know, this doesn't happen, that doesn't happen, this doesn't happen under Daley, under the old man.
Right.
And he ran Chicago.
That's correct. I mean, you know, there's something to be said about having, you know, absolute power.
Yeah.
It keeps order. It's sort of like what people were saying about, you know, the Iraq War. As bad as Saddam Hussein was, he kept everything under control.
So the guys.
And once you removed him, look what happened, right?
Yeah, sure.
Well, the same is true for gangsters. You know, whether you're talking about a city council boss who runs things with an iron hand, or Jackie Presser, or Whitey Bulger, like. South Boston was probably the most safest neighborhood in Boston. Yeah. You know, old ladies would just walk down the street with their purse open.
Yep.
Like, I know you're not going to mess with me, right? Because Whitey's going to take care of that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
The famous story.
There's a certain amount of order that comes with that.
Yeah, there's two famous stories. One is when Gotti goes to prison, he said, there's going to come a time you're going to wish I was back. And that's probably true now. And the other one was, it's one of my true favorites, in that Five Families when so many mugs, Vincent de Chin Gigante's mother on Marlborough Street. And then the guy doesn't realize he's a mugger, but he mugs this old lady. It's the Chin's mother.
Hmm.
And the whole place goes up in flames. And so the guy goes to the police station. This is, again, it's a great story. And turns himself in.
Right.
He said, I mugged the Chin's mother. Cops said, get out of here. we're not arresting you. Beat it. They said, you know, I mean... You mugged, he said, you did what? you mugged Vincent the Chin's mother? and they said, they threw him out. Never saw him.
Yeah, like, you're not going to burn down the police station. Like, you know, you're not coming here. I'm sorry, you're on your own.
The Chin will take care of this. You know.
Yeah, he's going to take care of that. And I don't want you in this house, right? This precinct.
They threw, as the story goes, Greg, they ran him out. Said, no, you're on your own. And never, hang on. Can I do a quick, get a chance to go through a break with you? Hang on, sir.
Of course.
Greg Morris here. The rest of 2021, most market experts think unlikely mortgage rates are going to stay in the twos. That means you want to purchase a new home or get a refi. Refis. You paid a lot of money in percentages on what you owe on your loan. Drop that number down. Let them do the refi. Tighten up the time. You're so far ahead. Say bunches. It's like in a pay raise. And you've waited long enough. Do it. That's right. They can do any loan, 10 years or longer. And you shouldn't have to pay interest on things and things you don't need, years you don't need. Call American Financing, 303-695-7000, 303-695-7000. Online, AmericanFinancing.net, NMLS 182334. Regulated by the Division of Real Estate, 303-695-7000. Please call them today. Coming up at 8 o'clock, John Eastman's on the show. Stephens this afternoon. Stay here.
News Talk 710 KNUS. Listen live at radio.com. Text the studio directly on the 710 KNUS app. Get it free at the App Store or Google Play.
Wednesday morning, everyone, the fifth morning of May, Cinco de Mayo. Pretty beautiful morning right now. Maybe rain this afternoon, sunny, warmer tomorrow, and Friday, warmer and storms. We'll see. Great guests is on hold. Greg Moore coming up. John Eastman's on the show. Mighty Plumbing and Heating. Right now, I know it's tough to sell AC, but I'm going to look at the weekend. Friday's going to be 82 degrees. Mighty Plumbing and Heating. Right now, the perfect time to schedule your AC tune-up. You're heading to the summer, and everybody's going to be calling for their tune-ups, and you'll be in the back of the line. Get ahead of it. My friend Kevin, who's been to my house three times, Kevin, Mighty Plumbing and Heating, right now for a mighty offer. It's a 30-point inspection and safety check for $69. Point inspection, $69. Go dyslexic that. The best deal in town. Mighty will meet or beat any written offer. They also take care of your plumbing and heating repairs and replace them with Rudd, the best equipment, tough engineered, built to last. Take this deal right now. Kevin and the family-owned business are the guys. Do it the Mighty way, Mighty Plumbing and Heating. Here's the phone, 720-340-1950. 720-340-1950. The web is mightyph.com, mightyph.com. 30-point inspection on your AC for $69. When it starts being like 85 every day, you're going to be so glad you did this. Good family folks, 720-340-1950 or mightyph.com. The one and only Greg Moore is with us, retired from the Denver Post, but a storied career. We're talking about Cleveland and talking about Jackie Presser. And then we talked about what took place when he joined the Globe. And then we're talking about what happened with organized crime. And it's really weird. I mean, trust factors, I have just seen too much. Any three-letter agency, federal agency that's got three letters. Greg, I'm leery of. Do you think that's... I mean, you've been through this. What do you do with it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there's... I mean, look, the FBI scandal in Boston, it was a shocker. I mean, it went all the way up... it went through the U.S. Attorney's Office to the highest levels of the FBI. And you just find out that, you know, some of the folks that you really trusted to, you know, aggressively protect neighborhoods and investigate crime were on the take. And for very little, you know, sometimes for... you know, rings, sometimes for houses, sometimes for cash, sometimes just because of old neighborhood alliances. It was really, I mean, anybody that has access to Boston Globe archives should really go back and read that coverage. It's eye-opening. And sadly, it's been replicated through various jurisdictions around the country, whether you're talking about police departments or other investigative agencies, you know, manipulating evidence and things of that nature. It can get pretty scary. That's one thing I learned, and one thing I firmly believe is you really don't want to get entangled with the criminal justice complex in this country. It's a pretty frightening experience, can be anyway.
Let me move to the next one, the institution, sure. The institution of my childhood, the church. When the Globe, and there's been a great film made of the Globe's job. And
sure, yeah.
I mean, they took on the church, in a predominantly Irish Catholic city, they took on the church.
Yeah, huge thing.
Speak
huge,
to them.
Huge
yeah.
thing. I'll tell you a funny story about it. I mean, you know, it's not because I'm a part of the story, but, you know, when Marty Baron, who you know, in the movie is played by, but Liv Scribner mm-hmm. or whatever his name is, the guy that plays Ray Donovan, who did a really great job on him. But this is one of the funny stories. It's not in the movie or anything like that. But, you know, Marty had just come to the newspaper become the editor in July of 1991. And it was after our first or second meeting, and a Globe columnist, celebrated columnist named Eileen McNamara had come to me and said, look, you know, in the 27th paragraph of the story, it says here that, you know, once this particular defendant is convicted or what have you, they're gonna close the records, and you're not going to have access to all the evidence that had been presented in this trial, and what are you going to do about this? And I was like, wow, I guess I only read to the 26th paragraph of that story. I didn't see that. So it turns out that, you know, I sent a note to Walter Robinson, who was running an investigative team called Spotlight, and said, look, I know you're doing some other things, because Spotlight operated independently from the newsroom, so they could investigate whoever, whatever they wanted for however long they thought it was necessary. And I just said, look, this is a really big story. Can you put whatever you're doing aside and see what you can do to get access to these records? And about a day and a half later, he said, yeah, we'll do it, which was really kind of unheard of for Spotlight. Because no matter what the newsroom asked him, generally Spotlight would say, no, we're doing something else, right? So we finished the morning meeting. This is a really funny story. And I'm walking back to my office, and Marty is walking with me. He's only been at the Globe for about 3 or 4 days. And I said, oh, yeah, you know, I forgot to tell you something. I launched a spotlight team to take a look at trying to get these records from the Catholic Church. He says, hey, you know, great idea. Sounds great. I said, no, you don't understand. The last time we, you know, investigated the church along these lines, Cardinal Law put a curse on the editor of the Globe, and Jack Driscoll fell down in his driveway, got a blood clot, and almost died.
Jeez.
He said, well, I don't give a care. I'm Jewish, and walked away. Okay. Like, it's one of the funniest stories ever.
Ooh.
But that's how that started. And, you know, Marty would, you know, while I'm, you know, working on picking page one and stuff, Marty would be in his office going over legal briefs, right, that were going to be submitted to the court on behalf of the Globe, getting access to those documents. I've never seen a person more focused on anything in my life. And we won that case in December of 2001, and we were shocked because basically Irish Catholic judges, you know, who had all gone to Boston College High School and all this, and they were altar boys in the church and all this kind of stuff. Routinely, the church would submit a document saying, you know, seal the file on this particular case, and the judges would just sign off because they're good Catholic boys and girls, right? And so, you know, in some ways, you when you look back at this, the court system is almost complicit in the Catholic Church, you know, pre-scandal, because they help perpetuate the cover-up by sealing those records just, you know, with a note from somebody from the Catholic Church. Hey, you mind seal that record? Boom, done. So the fact that we won access to those records, probably most likely from an Irish Catholic, you know, judge, was a huge, huge, huge thing. And it uncorked a global scandal that had been going on for 20 to 30 or 40 years. Amazing story.
No, I've read those books about what happened, and these are very brave men, very brave men and women, because the society would then turn on them. And we're watching it again now with Trump-appointed judges who say no, and they become traitors and become quislings and become communists. But I know those stories, that those judges that held the line. I got to urge you to read a book, and it's this book, Relentless Pursuit, about going after Jeffrey Epstein. But again and again and again, he has hired every powerful lawyer. He has every powerful political operative, every financier in his corner. And they block these women. They do. I mean, Alan Dershowitz just comes across as the worst human being. And they got Ken Starr, who was and Bill Clinton's on the manifest riding on the airplane 27 times. And, you know, I mean, you and I had this conversation. Greg Morris here, we had this conversation when Players and Sugar broke. Mm-hmm. It didn't have a damn thing to do with Michael Hancock. They were protecting other people.
Mm-hmm.
And
supposedly.
Yeah, allegedly. Yeah, allegedly,
who,
yes.
A who's who, yeah.
I think you're one of the few people that does know the truth about that. And the same thing is true. I don't know. But again, how they would – I mean, this guy's coming on the show, and I'm reading the end of the second book now called Dead Men Tell No Tales. And his brother is named Mark Epstein, and he clearly believes that they murdered that guy in the jail cell. Back to Whitey. You know, Whitey wasn't going to talk.
No, he definitely wasn't going to talk. But look, you know, I mean, you know, he's being transferred in the federal system, which is supposedly a lot safer than the state correctional system. Within an hour of being transferred, I believe it was to Atlanta, you know, his cell is left open. They actually have the cameras.
Yes.
Like, they had enough time to go in there, beat him, kill him, have a crew come in that's dressed like, you know, the cleanup crew to wipe up the blood and everything in there, go back out, right, before they discovered him. I mean, he was dead within an hour of being transferred to that facility. Now, you know, there was an early warning system. That was coordinated. It was coordinated. There's no question about it.
Yeah, I mean,
nobody's going to pay for that.
No. And the same thing with Epstein. The cameras are turned the other way, and the guy's supposed to be watching, and he's supposed to wear tearaway clothes because he's on suicide watch, and tearaway sheets. And And he had this guy, right. He had a guy who was cellmate, original cellmate, was like some, we used to call him Goombas when I was a kid growing up. He was in the cell
right.
with him. And,
right,
you know,
right,
and,
right.
And, I mean, you've heard that term.
I've heard it. Like, I don't know what happened, but, I mean, it is mighty suspicious.
He fell.
That
he
F team apparently had made an attempt on his life, yeah. right, that failed. And got a do-over? Like, okay,
no.
Like, come on. You don't get two shots at that.
That's really hard.
That's coordinated.
That Dr. Braden, he said, look, they killed him. And the official position, this comes back to the work that you do, the official position was he's a suicide, move on.
Right.
Because yeah, just think of...
like they say, dead man tell no tale.
Think if Epstein would have spoken. Think of Whitey. If Whitey would have started giving people up.
Oh, my God. Yeah, there's no telling what... you know, he probably, you know, quite frankly, he probably knows where Jimmy Hoffa is, too.
Sure.
A lot of things went down with him, right?
Whitey. I mean, there's a book called All Souls Day, and it's about just killing people. Like, just, you know, they had no... The same thing is true. I mean, there were hundreds of these young girls, and Dershowitz... blocks them, calls them liars.
Mm.
I mean, Dershowitz just is a total fill in the blank. I mean,
it's so funny. Dershowitz, you know, for a long, long time, like he represented Klaus von Bülow,
yes,
like
he did.
In the 1980s, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and actually got him off for allegedly killing his wife. But I mean, he was a celebrated lawyer in Boston. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you go back and you look at his background, he was the youngest tenured professor at the Harvard Law School, in the history of the law school. I mean, he was taking on all kinds of lost causes, you know, from Skokie on down, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, something happened. I don't know what happened to him, but, you know, he became associated with truly lost causes and taking on bizarre cases and making bizarre statements and things of that nature. And, you know, everybody gets old and, you know, things change in their lives, but, you know, I've never seen a person's reputation reversed as swiftly as Dershowitz's reputation's been reversed in the last 15, 20 years.
You read that?
He was really a special lawyer, you know, in the 70s and 80s.
I told everybody, you know, their time. I said, you think that these guys who write this book, they vetted this book 29 different ways. Where can we get sued? It's the same thing that with Julian. We're going to talk about that when we come back. But you vet these books, and this guy says Dershowitz is outside. He's upstairs molesting a kid, and Dershowitz is poolside with these 14-year-old girls. I mean, come on. I mean, it's
wow. Yeah.
Let me do a quick turnaround.
I know he's denied all that, but I got to read that book. I definitely have to read that book.
Hang on, sir.
Recommendation.
Right back with Greg Moore right after this on 710 KNUS.
Peter Boyles. News Talk 710 KNUS.
Greg Moore's on hold. The market report's coming up, and John Eastman in the wings. We go to Amy Duncan from Alpine. Can we do it quick, Amy? Good morning. What's the markets doing?
You bet, Pete. So, good Wednesday to you and the listeners. Quiet markets this morning. Dow is currently up 42, S&P positive, NASDAQ rallying this morning up almost 100 points after a big sell-off yesterday. And I was going to give a quick testimonial, but I'll just keep it quick. And that's a lot of investors have great intent, but no way to execute their plan or their goals. Whether it's getting money out of a 401k, having an aggressive savings plan, et cetera. Again, there's oftentimes good intent, but no way to implement the action. I think we often, you know, are the missing link for our clients. So work with a good advisor. Give us a call if you need some help taking action, getting your plan and your actions in place for a successful retirement. Brian and Gabe and I are here at Alpine Planning, standing by if you'd like to call and ask some questions.
Thank you so much. 303-843-0918, 843-0918, and they are there. Investing is a matter of trust. Markets are running, and they're there. 303-843-0918. Thanks, Amy. We'll talk tomorrow. Thank you.
Okay.
Securities and investment advisory services offered through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA SIPC and registered investment advisor. Alpine Planning Group and Woodbury Financial Services, Inc. are not affiliated entities. 14 West Dry Creek Circle, Littleton, Colorado, 80120.
Our guest is Greg Moore, formerly with the Denver Post. We were both at a get-together. We had all read this dropping book that's entitled The Holly, and it's going to come out on the 11th. Your thoughts of the book and what should happen, indeed, after this begins to be read?
Well, first of all, I thought the book was really, really good. It's a riveting read. And, you know, as I was saying when we were together, I was reading it in the bathroom, and I was sticking my arm out of the shower, reading through the glass. It was that compelling. You know, what I think should happen is that people should sort of focus on, you know, what happens to a neighborhood, what happens to a community when, you know, it's overtaken by gangs and gang violence. But it's also a story of, you know, sort of heroic proportions. I mean, Park Hill is a thriving community. I mean, property values are going up, have been going up. It's becoming a more integrated community. And so, like, even when bad things happen to a neighborhood, you know, it is able to rise up. And I think that that's the second part of that story that probably will be told either in subsequent books or, you know, in the first draft of history that's going to be done by journalists. I mean, I think descending on that neighborhood in terms of what should happen next and finding out what has happened since, you know, the revival of Holly Square, but also the revival of a neighborhood, is a really good story. It's a really good story, and it's probably the phase two, the you know.
Yeah, I mean,
I saw so much of it.
Yeah, I saw so much of it. There's an event on Tuesday. You're going to attend on Tuesday? Have you put in?
No,
for
I'll be. My schedule is booked months in advance, so I won't be there. Okay. But I know other people who are coming.
Yeah. I'm gonna take my daughter. She's.
You're talking about the Tattered Culver event,
no,
right?
No, there's another one too, but you know.
Oh, okay.
I'm trying to pull this thing off, and I talked to Julian yesterday, and thousands of years ago, when Bill Owens was governor, we did one state, one book, and we chose a book, and it was Pete Hamill's The Snow. And I'm going to do one city, one book, but I don't know. We're struggling with how to do it because I think this is one of those books. Was there anybody in that book that you didn't know? Because I knew everybody, I think, almost.
I pretty much knew everybody. Yeah. There were a few people, you know, who had, like, little gangbanger names that I didn't know. Yeah. But, you know, all the public players I knew, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, before my time, there was guys that I didn't know them. But
starting
about whatever time frame when this all begins, well, I know that guy, I know that guy, I know that guy, you know, and media characters and politicians. And so I think it's a must read. I just don't know how you pull it off.
Well, you know, I mean, I think the city of Denver still has one city, one book. I mean, that was started by Hickenlooper.
No, we started it. Started before that, but we did the state.
You started before that, but
no big deal.
You know what? I think if you tell people that you think that's a book that they ought to read, that'll get the ball rolling. Mm. And I do think it's a book that, you know, people in greater Metro Denver ought to read because it's just a really interesting book. Yeah. I mean, Michael Hancock and, you know, John Hickenlooper is in it.
Oh, yeah.
It reminds you of the old model cities days when government funds were, you know, poured into, you know, sort of underserved communities and sometimes didn't make it where it was supposed to go. I mean, there's just a lot of really interesting stuff in there. And then there are characters like Reverend Leroy Kelly, who is still around and still doing important work there,
still
but he's the main character in that book.
Let me do this. I hear the music. Your schedule will come back. You're a wonderful guest. It's about time you do the show. Talk to Billy, and we'll bring you back. Greg, thanks, man. We'll talk ASAP.
All right.
Thank you, sir. On the other side, he was visiting scholar John Eastman and let go to the University of Colorado, and he has two attorneys now, and he has Chuck Monowell and Randy Corcoran, and this is an interesting story. He was with Donald Trump on the January 6th morning. We'll see where it goes. 62 will be the high. Stay right here.